This is the morning brief from the Economic Times.
100 years of the Chinese Communist Party. Long live China, because the People's Republic of China is the world's oldest surviving communist state, along with North Korea. And it looks like there's no stopping China. Most of the world's economies shrank after getting battered by the coronavirus pandemic. But China managed to contain the pandemic early and saw its GDP grow. Never mind global allegations that the virus actually leaked from a Chinese lab in Wuhan. China won't take any criticism lightly. In fact, Chinese President Xi Jinping, while speaking at the 100th anniversary celebrations of the CCP, said that any foreign forces who tried to bully or oppress China would have their heads bashed bloody against a great wall of steel.
The President Xi Jinping hailed the country's development, saying that the era of China being bullied and slaughtered is gone forever.
The Chinese people will never allow any foreign forces to bully, oppress or enslave us.
China has also said that it is expanding its nuclear arsenal, and it has been racking up military tensions with its neighbors, both with India and Ladakh and in the South China Sea with Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia and Philippines. And that brings us to a big question. Who can stand up to China? You'll get answers to this question and several more in our insightful discussion today on China's past, present and future. I'm Anjali Venugopalan and you're listening to The Morning Brief. It's the 13th of July, Tuesday, and to decode China's phenomenal economic rise and its growing geopolitical dominance, we have with us our guests, Amitendu Palit, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore, and Pranab Dhal Samanta, Deputy Executive Editor at the Economic Times. So, Amitendu, I'll start with you. Despite its communist ideology, private businesses have really grown in China and grown fast. I mean, China has the most number of billionaires after the US. How do you explain this?
Anjali, I think one of the points about the Chinese Communist Party and China itself is important to note at the outset. The country, including its systems and, of course, the dominant actor, that's the Chinese Communist Party, over the last 100 years, it's shown a remarkable ability to change. It's been very flexible. It's been very agile. It's adjusted to circumstances that have evolved around it in as accommodating a fashion as possible. And the results are there to be seen. If you look at the time that has come since 1978, when Deng Xiaoping actually decided to change the way China should adjust to the global economy and change its policies accordingly, we have seen China's spectacular economic successes. But what this essentially means is that if you look back at the time when all this began, there was actually no indication of the fact that China would do what it did, because even at that time, the Cold War was pretty much raging across the world. The Soviet communist bloc was active, much as there were stirrings in between. But China still decided to go ahead, gather itself together into a series of spaces, which eventually became the foundation on which it worked on an export-oriented strategy. The interesting thing is that unlike a large number of other middle-income countries, China was never stagnant in terms of the specializations that it wanted to produce. So very quickly, it transitioned from a system of reproducing technology to actually building technology on its own. And it was perfectly conscious about the fact that that required a very different kind of ecosystem, including giving a more freer rein to a lot of individual ideas, households, and thoughts. And that's why you probably see a system being laid out where we now today experience startups which have experienced phenomenal growth. I mean, Alibaba, for example, the Tencent Holdings, the Xiaomi, the Oppos, and the Vivos. This has been the singular ability of China that keep in tune with the changes that the world economy is picking up, adjust to those, play within the institutions, and at the same time, ensure that once comparative advantages are protected, they don't remain static, but you move ahead with the changing times.
That actually brings me to the next question. There seems to be a shift in thinking in China, right? I mean, we're seeing the state crack down on these large internet businesses in particular that you mentioned. And in fact, I mean, China's most visible billionaire, Jack Ma, has all but dropped from public view right now. So, why do you think this is happening? And how will this affect China's growth going forward?
I asked him how he stays ahead of the regulators, and he says,
"And the government loves me because, you know, I'm helping them to create a business."
He had that brashness back in 2005. So that brashness has now come back and kind of nipped the showman in the rear end.
For quite some time, China has been working on what the Chinese system defines as the socialist market economy. Now, you're free to interpret what a socialist market economy means, but from a Chinese perspective, a socialist market economy probably means is retaining the socialist command structure as much as possible, but within those, give an opportunity to the markets to flourish. And when the markets are allowed to flourish, you have to let individuals flourish, the privates flourish. This is inconsistent with the larger vision of socialism, because socialism has always given prevalence to the system and institutions, not individuals. What this also means is that you have unleashed a genie, which you need to cork at some stage, because people like Jack Ma have reached a position where, because of the control over the assets they have, can actually command substantial strategic influence within the Chinese system, which could well be a threat to the current establishment. So I think that is something which has underpinned a particular realization within the Chinese Communist Party, particularly since the time Xi Jinping assumed the reins of the party, which has coincided with a phase of what we typically describe as purging. A lot of rent-seeking has been minimized. A lot of corruption activities have been, attacked. Some would say that such corruption activities and targets have been identified because they are not really necessarily sympathetic to the system. The state is going to dominate operations, and it is abundantly clear that within that space, if there are individuals who try to reach that position of equivalence, insofar as prominence and authority are concerned, such parallel existence will not be tolerated by Chinese state.
So clearly, socialism is coming back in a big way to China's market economy. Pranab, it's been 100 years since the founder of the Chinese Republic, Mao Zedong, attended the first ever Congress of the Chinese Communist Party. And since then, there had been a lot of turmoil, like during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. But since the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests, there has been no major revolt in China. Why is that?
In 1989, students are killed at the Tiananmen Square. Thousands gather to demand democracy, free speech and a free press. The Communist Party sends tanks to fight them. The massacre of innocent students is met with international criticism and isolation.
I don't think people in Hong Kong are going to agree with you that easily. But anyways, the question is relevant. And the Chinese economy has grown 30 times. Since 1989. So what happened? China prior to 1989 was still like wedded to the ideal of communism at some level, though the changes had already begun under Deng Xiaoping. The Tiananmen Square incident actually was a watershed moment from where, in my view, you can sort of trace the growth of modern day Chinese nationalism. I think the Chinese Communist Party two stumps. One was a high trajectory economic growth, a strong nationalist sort of oriented politics, which go with high trajectory economic growth. And with that, the narrative of the China we hear today started taking shape. That has been a big plus for China, which is now the second largest economy in the world. The Chinese have a new identity about themselves, a new economic identity, and that economic identity is wedded to a strong national identity, which is definitely very different from the China pre-1989. That Chinese nationalism, as long as that is there, a lot of the dissent is sort of, you know, it stays below the radar. Even if it pops up, it goes back, because Chinese nationalism kind of has this overarching layer over every other sentiment. And remember, China is not exactly a very diverse society in terms. Their minorities are mostly dominated by one particular ethnic sect. So over a period of time, all of the Chinese cultural elements, etc., have kind of fused into this communist nationalist narrative, which is unique by itself in many ways. So yeah, that's why it explains. I think the short answer to your question is the rise of Chinese nationalism and the birth of a new Chinese identity kind of overlays on any dissent at any point.
Right. And your point about homogeneity is important, I think, because dissent against China has come in from pockets that consider themselves distinct from the mainland Chinese, right? So, and China has pursued an aggressive policy of silencing, you know, these very people, you know, when it comes to Hong Kong or internally with the Uyghur Muslims. And it seems to say that it will go the same way with Taiwan as well. How do you think this will affect its relationship with other countries?
So China has been very successful, and thanks to its growing economic clout in pursuing the and pushing the One China policy. Most of the countries in the world, starting with America, including India, have broadly at some point in history agreed to the One China policy. So even though we have these protests on democracy, the idea eventually is to get all the other democracies to come together and sort of agree on some punitive measures on China. That's a big ask, given the economic dependencies many of these countries have. Having said that, the review in various countries is at various levels. So over a period of time, you will find democracies coming together, but whether they can agree on punitive measures, whether they can completely decouple, these are all long processes. And I don't see anything happening immediately, but you will notice trends like the Quad, for example.
Right. And I think we're already seeing several countries moving to place restrictions on China, right? So, Amitendu, we've had countries like, you know, India, Australia, and the US, you know, restrictions on both Chinese goods and investment. And yet China continues to grow. Why is that? And do you think this would, you know, become a hurdle in their growth going forward?
Anjali, I think we need to note one thing, and this is just expanding from this description that Pranab provided in terms of the economic dependence that countries of the rest of the world have on China. I am quite fond of, you know, narrating the statistics off the top of my head that around 80% of what most of the world uses from the time it gets up in the morning till it goes to bed at night has some economic contribution from the mainland China. Now, what that essentially means is that the production networks across the world have got so intricately linked to China that it is very difficult to disconnect from that interdependence overnight or even over the foreseeable future of 3 to 4 years. If you look at industries like pharmaceuticals, China is the largest global producer of active pharmaceutical ingredients, which are used in the finished dose formulations, and China didn't reach that overnight. It reached that position because of conscious decisions by the Western economies, who are the topmost manufacturers of pharmaceutical formulations, to outsource the lower parts of the supply chain to China because they didn't want to hold on to those themselves, and China was able to do it very effectively, efficiently. This happened at a point of time in the world when global business and countries were focusing far more on efficiency and productivity as opposed to national security concerns, which is now the primary concern. Now, the question is, does it impact China in the long term? Well, you know, the long term is very indefinite. But in the foreseeable future, what we do realize is that, yes, there will be certain impacts. But I would argue that the Chinese economy and the Chinese state has anticipated this. And let's not also forget, We often talk about China just as a producer for the rest of the world. We tend to overlook the fact how important is China as a consumer for the rest of the world. China's economic success over the last 40 years has enabled it to push a large number of its people above the poverty line. They now have reasonable power and income to actually afford a large number of goods which earlier China could not sell in the domestic market. So to that extent, what China is probably going to do is to confine a large traditional manufacturing basket within the economy. But when it comes to areas like, say, for example, critical minerals, semiconductors, large capacity batteries, yes, it's going to remain very well integrated with the rest of the world.
You've talked about, you know, China being the biggest producer of pharmaceuticals in the world, right? In fact, it's this dependence on China for pharmaceuticals that had the US pretty worried last year. And then, you know, combined with that, we have a lot of global mistrust towards China right now because of the allegations, you know, that the COVID-19 virus leaked from a Chinese lab in Wuhan. And at the same time, like you mentioned, you know, the world still depends on China. You know, China is both a factory for the world and, you know, as well as a big export market. So do you think these factors would play a bigger role going forward in speeding up the decoupling?
Actually, as I said, look, there is today a realization that China is beginning to exploit the dependence of the rest of the world on it economically in a manner which could be inimical to the greater interests of the rest of the world. And that has been exposed by COVID-19. So as a result of that, you see a lot of collective initiatives that have come up. I mean, these primarily include initiatives like the Resilient Supply Chain Initiative, which Japan, India, Australia are combining to work on together.
At a time China is engaged in a global trade war with the US threatening its exports, Asia's largest economy is now facing another big threat, which is of companies leaving country. Now Japan will start paying its companies to move factories out of China and back home or to Southeast Asia. Move is a part of new program to secure supply chains and de-risk from overdependence on China.
You also see the United States, the Biden administration, having come out with a fairly detailed review of the supply chains and critical industries, where it is conscious about the fact it is underpinning that urgency to decouple from China. But it's also at the same time not very sanguine, not very confident about the fact that how does one diversify when you cut short your sourcing requirements from China? From a business perspective, that volume or that chunk of inputs or raw materials need to be obtained from somewhere else. Now, where are those locations? Are they in a position to supply those to the markets and businesses in as much amount and competitive prices? That is the challenge which is now having to be handled by global businesses across the world.
Got it. So from what I understand, there seems to be no big alternative to China when it comes to manufacturing. Pranab, what's the political fallout of this economic rise of China?
Let's look at China. You know, the thing is, if you look at the economic miracles in East Asia, starting with Japan and then Korea and the ASEAN countries.
ASEAN refers to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
So China kind of added to that great story. And it had Western support starting through the 90s. Bill Clinton even shepherded it to enter the WTO, for instance. So there was this whole hope that China would move in a certain direction. And it will probably appear just like, you know, like it happened in South Korea. It happened in many of the East Asian countries. China also will kind of fall into this larger global narrative. And everybody was betting on what those days was termed as the peaceful rise of China. That ship has sailed. That has not happened. What I'm trying to say is China's economic rise is combined with raw military physical aggression. Not just that, it has also resorted to economic aggression to make its point. So when the question, the heart of the question is, becomes physical security of countries, of political entities, then the narrative begins to shift. I quite agree, you can't find alternatives overnight, But if they have to be found, they will have to be found. And that sort of thing will continue to happen.
Right. And Pranab, we're seeing this huge pushback when it comes to COVID-19, right? There's a lot of debate about where the virus originated from. And one of the accusations is that it originated from China, and China covered it up.
It's not about whether the virus, where it originated, though that's a separate debate. What you must understand is, why is this debate there? Why is it that everybody is asking this question? Politics is about creating issues, not always, it's not a straight line. Everybody wants to make China the issue. And that is very interesting. We want to know what happened in China, because we are not going to condone any more cover-ups. Because for a long time, Chinese economy has been opaque. The way their companies have run, they have been opaque. Their system of accounting has been opaque. All of that, their contract procedures have been opaque. But because they provided a predictable model, everybody kept quiet. So you see China emerging as an issue, and the virus origin debate must be seen in that context. There is a lot of things to where, how gain of function research was being done in the Wuhan lab, what was being done. So they want Chinese to show some amount of transparency come out. But China says, we have cooperated with one WHO expert team, and that is it. That relates to another issue of the clout which the Chinese enjoy in international organizations, to begin with WHO. And now you look at, I mean, there are enough studies out there, if you look at key UN bodies, and there's a healthy number, 16 or 17 of them, where China is either heading them or is at the number two. So these are all important political debates which are happening as to how China has influenced international bodies, has taken control over them, is influencing rulemaking. And therefore, the origin of the virus issue is also about getting WHO to act, about at least being more forceful on China. So you are dealing with the behemoth. But the important thing is, China is being made an issue of. There is a desire to name and shame China politically. And this is classic politics. So don't look for an end game over here. This is about building an issue and keeping that issue alive.
So from what I understand, I mean, obviously there is a lot of political pushback from countries which would affect the economy of China as well, right? But at the same time, Pranab, I mean, Xi Jinping, he spoke about how China would pursue this new type of international relations. And, you know, he also spoke about the Belt Road Initiative after this. And, you know, China has pursued this strategy of, you know, money buying friendship, right? So do you think this would still work going forward?
The Belt and Road Initiative aims to link economies of countries in Asia, Europe, and Africa into a China-centered trading network.
The Belt and Road Initiative. As we speak, roads, railway lines, shipping routes, ports, oil refineries, industrial parks, and power plants are being built in at least 72 countries. It's a massive initiative.
You see, Amitendu may be able to put better light on the micro details, but from what I understand and what we also see by first-hand experience in countries like Sri Lanka, even in Pakistan, this Belt Road Initiative, the financing model actually creates more dependencies on China. They take loan and then they're in a debt trap. Okay, so even these countries, I mean, that's still a work in progress. These countries may also want alternatives. And you saw that discussion happen at the recent G7 meet, and also, I think, somewhat in the G20 meet, but more at the G7 meet. Can we create alternate financing models for countries in Africa and others who want to build infrastructure, airports, cities, whatever it is? Why should they be only dependent on cheap Chinese finance? It's a tough road ahead, because China has got a head start. It has gamed the situation much better. It is flushed with money. Its economy is doing way better than the rest. So it's a hard walk ahead, but the intent has never been higher than this. So the political intent is at its highest at this point in time, because on one thing everybody agrees, an alternative is always better. It gives you more comfort. No alternative is bad. And with Chinese aggression, everybody knows it's a question of today or tomorrow.
Right. So despite China's strategy of buying political loyalty through money, many countries will look for an alternative because of Chinese aggression, right? So Mitendu, what do you have to say on this?
Look, I think it's important to focus on one particular issue at the outset, that how did China actually happen to emerge as a leading provider of funds to the rest of the world? If one looks at the smaller economies, for example, Sri Lanka, Maldives, let's say, for example, a country like Kenya, and even our neighboring Bangladesh. The point is that for a large number of these countries and the greater Indo-Pacific region, infrastructure and public goods and connectivity have been at a deficit. They have been looking out for funds, but unfortunately, the Western donor development assistance became so stringent, became so much packed with nuanced conditionalities that these countries were at a loss to access funds. And the ability of Western private donors to provide funds substantially went down after the 2009 financial crisis. And China stepped in into that vacuum. So for example, if you look at a country like Sri Lanka, it's not being backed by Western donors. The Commonwealth is not stepping in to play a big role. But China suddenly turns up and says that no questions asked, lower conditionalities, but I only demand your strategic loyalty. It's up to the country to make a choice. So I think let's not be under this great idea that the United States will back up and come to the defense of all anti-China alliances. But what is important is for a large number of other countries who are neither the United States nor the China, to think of how to come together for tackling first an incredibly aggressive, aspiring and assertive China, and secondly, a United States, which is too much crippled by its own internal domestic challenges to play as productive a role in international affairs as it was doing earlier. It is important for countries like India, Australia, Japan, and the United Kingdom, typically what we call a group of middle powers and democracies, to actually come together and think and focus on what might be the alternative so that as a group, as a club, they're able to reduce their respective dependencies on China. And by doing so, they can offer a constructive, transparent template.
Right. So I think you've answered the, you know, central question of this podcast, that, you know, who can stand up to China, right? So Aparna, the same question to you, really. I mean, the US seems to be on retreat globally. But at the same time, we are seeing this sort of political pushback. So who can stand up to China? I know it's a very vox pop type of question, but what's your view on this?
There is no one answer. I think that there are many countries groping for that. As I said earlier, there is political intent. But what shape that takes on ground, we don't know yet and should not think too far ahead in politics. But there is political intent. I think you will see a lot of action move out of the UN because of the point I made earlier about new Chinese presence. So there'll be outfits like the Quad or different kind of contact groups where all these decisions will be made and some kind of coalition come together. You will also have a challenge being put to China in terms of elections to key bodies. Maybe 6-7 countries come together and put up joint candidates. I think it happened in WIPO.
WIPO refers to World Intellectual Property Organization,
where the Singaporean candidate was a consensus candidate and he defeated the Chinese candidate. So these kind of standing up to China will happen. China will win some, China will lose some. I do agree that the United States is not the power it used to be, but it still is among the democracies a very powerful country. We have also seen, if you look at it for take the vaccination, also the making of vaccines in the world, you realize that United States actually controls 80% of supply chains for vaccine raw materials. It was a learning for all of us. So, and US is investing in manufacturing, in semiconductor industry and things like that. So I think that's the direction in which the United States will go.
Right, as we have seen with the COVID-19 origins debate. What role do you think the US will play going forward? Like, Amitendu mentioned, there's a lot of internal problems that the US is dealing with right now.
How United States economy builds up, how United States is able to get its act together, that is something we'll have to watch out. It's a very polarized polity, but let's not forget, it still is a power. And therefore, it is better to have US in the room, not outside the room, number one. Number two, in the room, you can influence the US. You may not succeed all the time. In Afghanistan, you've not succeeded. But in Indo-Pacific, you might. So you will have to take your chances. It'll not be, you know, you'll not get everything what you want. But the United States has the economic and military might, which is necessary, absolutely necessary, to be part of a grouping or a coalition to stand up to China. The Chinese, obviously, on their side, would like to have, and here I am walking out on a limb maybe, would like to have forge a new understanding with the United States. I mean, the whole multipolar order which we talk about, one has always seen that China also would not mind a China-US sort of core to this new multipolar order. So China will also be working its levers with the United States. But at the end of it, it will be on issues and instances where you'll see the world standing up to China, and that will create its own dynamic for the next issue and the next issue thereafter.
China, with all its contradictions, has managed to rise to the near top of the world economy and politics. But can it scale the summit? It seems that many of the world's economies are now determined to stand in its way. In March this year, the Quad, an informal grouping of the US, India, Japan, and Australia, met and talked about a free and open Indo-Pacific region. And while it will take decades for the world to decouple from China, it doesn't look impossible anymore. The dragon might be roaring today about heads being bashed bloody, but there are many with the courage to face up to it. I'm Anjali Venugopalan, and you've been listening to The Morning Brief. This episode was edited and coordinated by Nehal Chaliawala. Please send in your feedback to The Morning Brief at timesgroup.com. And if you like the episode, do share it on your social media handles. The Morning Brief airs every Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. All clips used in this podcast belong to their respective owners. Credits are mentioned in the description. Thank you for listening and have a great day.